Hello, this is Ian Berg with the Commercial News, dated Wednesday, February 13th, 2019. We'll start today's reading on the front page of the paper with the article, Committee Considers Hike in Large Garbage Pickup Fee, by Jennifer Bailey, Danville. Driving around the city, especially during the last few weeks, residents probably have seen large piles of furniture and other items cleaned out from a residence. The $75 fee is not covering what it costs the city, in one instance an hour and a half, to pick up all of the items, said Interim Public Works Director Carl Carpenter. Members of the City's Council Public Works Committee discussed Tuesday night increasing the large cleanup collection fee to $300. Under the current ordinance, major cleanup collections are more than three large items and/or multiple bags of items not containing household waste. The size of the major cleanup collections are those that exceed dimensions of 5 feet wide by 10 feet long by 3 feet high, or other dimensions totaling more than 150 cubic feet. The first and second major cleanup collections in a calendar year are now $75. Subsequent major cleanup collections are $200 each. The owner or occupant must call the Public Works Department, pay, and schedule the pickup. Carpenter said the cost to the city last fiscal year was about $103,000. Revenue projected was $60,000 this fiscal year, but as of last month, only $16,000 was received. Revenue now proposed for the next fiscal year is set at $37,500. The $300 fee would get us closer to what major collections fees are, he said. As of January 8th, the city has seen 234 major setouts this fiscal year. It is a blight problem, Carpenter said. City officials said they don't want to raise fees even more for all solid waste customers to pay for the big collections. They wanted more of a user fee. Carpenter said most, about 70%, are rental and not owner-occupied properties. This fiscal year, of the 234, 165 have been rental properties. Last fiscal year, there were 253 major collections and 192 were rental properties. It is a large issue, Carpenter said. Resident Vince Kors asked why the city picks up the items from move-outs. He asked, don't landlords buy the dumpsters and do the cleanup themselves? Placing the dumpsters in certain areas is difficult, and Carpenter said the city would rather not have the items dumped illegally or placed along roads elsewhere. Somebody has got to get it, he said. He and other aldermen agree landlords with their businesses can pay the higher fee. It's a fee that has to be charged, Carpenter said. He also said the city still takes lumber and other items the city ordinance doesn't call for. What choice do we have? He asked, saying they don't want to leave the items there. Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. said they're not looking to increase the minor collection fee, which is no charge for the first one and $20 after that. Solid waste customers already will see their monthly garbage fee increase to $25.50 in May 2019, $26.25 in 2020, and $27 in 2021. Aldermen next month are expected to act on the major cleanup collection fee increase. We'll continue next with the article, Oakwood Names Maynard as Superintendent, by Carol Rome. Oakwood. Larry Maynard, a longtime school administrator in East Central Illinois, will become Oakwood's new superintendent of schools starting July 1st. Maynard will succeed Gary Lewis, who will step down from the Oakwood post July 1st to serve as regional superintendent of schools in Champaign and Ford counties, a position he ran uncontested for during the November general election. During a special meeting Monday night, the Oakwood School Board entered into a three-year contract with Maynard, who has been Potomac Grade School's superintendent and principal since July of 2017. His salary was set at $115,000 for the first year. A search for Lewis's successor began last fall, 14 initially applied for the Oakwood superintendent job. Those applicants were narrowed down to 7 candidates, and then eventually to 4 finalists who were interviewed on January 28th through 29th. Maynard was one of 2 finalists interviewed last week for a second time. It's a very different role from what I'm used to at the grade school, but it's an opportunity I'm looking forward to, Maynard said. It seemed like a good fit. Maynard said he has developed an entry plan with Lewis so we can facilitate a good, healthy transition. Maynard's career in education is lengthy, spanning decades across central Illinois. I've been very fortunate to work in school districts that have offered different roles, he said. Maynard holds a master's degree in sports administration from Illinois State University and a master's degree in education administration from Eastern Illinois University. He earned his superintendency endorsements in 2014 from Eastern and the Illinois Association of School Administrators. Early in his career, he coached at Illinois Wesleyan University, taught and coached at Normal Community High School, and served as head football coach and dean of students at Eureka High School. Later, Maynard taught and coached at Paxton Buckley Loda High School and Rantoul Township High School, and served as principal at Judah Christian School in Champaign, before returning to Rantoul Township High School as dean of students and assistant principal for 3 years. Maynard came to Vermilion County as principal of Hoopston Area High School for 10 years, before leaving 1.5 years ago to succeed Jamie Dorsey, who retired in 2017 as Potomac Grade School's superintendent and principal. It's been an awesome experience to be a superintendent principal at the grade school. It's allowed me the opportunity to learn and grow, he said. I've been fortunate to work with some of the best educators in Vermilion County. He said he will miss Potomac Grade School's staff and students, adding, "This place captures a person's heart." Maynard said he and the Potomac School Board have had a great communication leading up to this. We're working on a transition plan, but we haven't officially posted anything about the job yet. Maynard and his wife, Tracy, who works as a wellness director for Gibson Area Hospital's Paxton Clinic, have 2 college-age daughters. We're excited, he said. My family is excited and grateful for the opportunity. Next, we'll go to the article, Hospitals Must Now Post Cost of Services, by Mary Wyckoff. Danville. Patients with OSF healthcare have always been able to call and request an estimate. Now, a new federal law requires hospitals to post their prices online. As of January 1st, the Department of Health and Human Services, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, requires hospitals to make their standard charges public via the internet in a machine-readable format and to update this information at least annually. OSF Healthcare recently expanded the price request tool on its website for each of its 13 hospitals. The information found there allows patients to call or complete a fillable form, providing basic information such as their insurance carrier and the OSF Healthcare facility they would like to have a procedure at. They receive an estimate back from the Financial Clearance Center within 1 business day. Whether using the form or phone number, patients will get a detailed and accurate picture of what they will pay. OSF has had 51 requests so far, in total from all 13 hospitals, according to Lori A. Hurwitz, Senior Vice President, Revenue Cycle Administration in Peoria. We also send out approximately 3,000 estimates each month to patients who are having scheduled procedures, surgeries, or certain diagnostic exams. We do that automatically. The patient does not have to request. As of February 1st, OSF has had very limited response. Patients have not found the posted chargemaster very helpful, she said. We expected that. Again, we support the effort for increased transparency, and this is a first step. A chargemaster is a comprehensive listing of items billable to a hospital patient or a patient's healthcare insurance provider. OSF can track how often patients look at the data. The views have been very low, around 10 to 20 per day, Hurwitz said. Price estimates provided to patients show their estimated out-of-pocket cost based on their insurance plan. It includes physician fees for services provided by physicians employed by OSF, she said. According to the website, price estimates are based on the fee schedule rate as provided by Epic Systems, the contracted rate for the patient's insurance plan, and the calculated out-of-pocket costs based on the patient's benefit information. The charges are posted in the format required by CMS. Patients will need the exact 5-digit Common Procedural Terminology, or CPT code, for the procedure needed so they're getting the price for the exact test or surgery. We support the intention to provide more transparency in pricing, but know that very few patients would be able to pull all the related charges together or know what they would be, then would have to contact their insurance company to ask what their out-of-pocket would be, Hurwitz said. That is why we are committed to providing estimates which are calculated based upon service expected to be provided and the patient's specific insurance benefit plan. As for those who are uninsured, OSF does not negotiate prices. It is required to charge everyone the same amount for similar services. However, there is a discount for uninsured patients who meet the financial assistance guidelines. OSF officials understand how complex and confusing the hospital billing process can be, and so patient service representatives are available to help patients understand their bill and what portion is their responsibility. While the website has a lot of information, OSF encourages patients to call with questions about their own personal situation, so they may receive accurate information about out-of-pocket costs. Patients with questions should not hesitate to contact us, Hurwitz said. We are here to assist with estimates and can ease the process for our patients. The toll-free number is 800-421-5700. We will now go to the death notices. Bonnie Lee Dierdoff, 89, of Danville, passed away on Monday, February 11th. Funeral service will be at 10 a.m. on Saturday, February 16th, at Robison Chapel in Catlin. Burial in Rockfield Cemetery in Vetersburg, Indiana. Memorials may be made to Catlin Church of Christ. Teresa Nimick, 55, of Largo, Florida, passed away on Saturday, February 9th. The family requests, in lieu of flowers, donations be made in her memory to the Florida Cancer Specialists Foundation. Friends and family will gather at 3 p.m. Eastern on Friday, February 15th, at the Moan Funeral Home. A service will follow at 4 p.m. John William Snavely, 66, of the Rileysburg area, passed away on Sunday, February 10th. A visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. on Thursday, February 14th. Funeral service will follow at 3 p.m. Eastern in Shelby Funeral Home in Covington, Indiana. Burial will be in Hopewell Cemetery. The family requests memorials to the Perrysville Volunteer Fire Department. Charles A. Richards, 88, of Danville, passed away on February 11th. A celebration of Charles's life will be at 1 p.m. on Friday, February 15th, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, February 14th, at the funeral home. He will be laid to rest at Sunset Memorial Park in Danville. Memorials can be made in Charles's name to the charity of the donor's choice. Ruth Bonebrack, 81, of Georgetown, passed away on Sunday, February 10th. A celebration of Ruth's life will be at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, February 13th, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center of Georgetown, at 200 East West Street. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to her service on Wednesday at the funeral home. She will be laid to rest in Georgetown Cemetery. Memorial donations may be given in her name to donor's choice of charity. John Edward DeRay, 55, of Danville, passed away on February 8th. Private family services will be on Wednesday, February 13th, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Oakwood. Burial will be in Oakwood Cemetery. Memorials in John's memory may be given to the Vermilion Heights Christian Church. We'll continue next, now, with the article, Nominations Sought for Awards, a staff report. The Illinois Small Business Development Center, or SBDC, at Danville Area Community College, seeks nominations to recognize contributions of the Vermilion County area's entrepreneurs. To recognize accomplishments at all stages of business growth, awards will be given out in five categories. Small Business of the Year. A small business in business 2 years or more that has successfully passed the initial startup phase and has accomplished expansion goals. Small Business Startup of the Year. A small business in business less than 2 years that has successfully created a business plan, obtained financing, and opened its doors. Entrepreneur of the Year. A small business owner who has distinguished him or herself by achieving a business goal or by overcoming adversity to continue the business operation. Legacy Business of the Year. A small business that has operated successfully for more than 10 years. Incubator Small Business of the Year. A small business that is home-based or operates out of a co-work space, incubator, commercial kitchen, or consignment space. To nominate a business for one of the awards, send an email to sbdc@dacc.edu with information about the nominee by 5 p.m. March 8th. To mail a nomination, forms are available at www.dacc.edu/sbdc. These small business stars will be recognized at a breakfast on May 9th at the Danville Country Club. For information, contact the Illinois SBDC at DACC, Director Carol Nichols at 217-213-6269. The Illinois SBDC at DACC is sponsored in part by the Small Business Administration, the State of Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, and Danville Area Community College. Next, we'll continue with Lawmakers to Turn Attention to Marijuana, by Rebecca Ansel and Peter Hancock at the Capital News, Illinois. Springfield. Attention at the State House is expected to begin focusing on one of Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's top priorities, legalizing recreational marijuana, with the deadline Friday for lawmakers to introduce new bills. Two key Chicago Democratic lawmakers, Senator Heather Steens and Representative Kelly Cassidy, have met with interested groups around Illinois and are expected to introduce legislation soon. Meanwhile, though, Representative Carol Ammons, a Democrat from Urbana, has already introduced a bill that is drawing attention. It would open the door to much more expansive legal pot industry than most others have envisioned. Ammons' bill, the Cannabis Legalization Equity Act, would allow anyone 21 or older with valid identification to purchase or sell marijuana. Driving under the influence of the drug would still be illegal, and the legislation makes specific mention that only legitimate taxpaying business people would be permitted to sell cannabis. Illinoisians under the measure could possess as many as 224 grams, or roughly half a pound, of marijuana at a time. It would also allow individuals to grow as many as 24 plants in their homes for personal consumption, and it would provide the licensing of cultivation facilities and retail dispensaries. Ammons did not respond to requests for comment Monday. Her measure includes language, though, indicating its purpose would be to allow law enforcement to focus on violent and property crimes, generating revenue for education and other public purposes, and individual freedom. "We like it. We think that's more in line with how we treat alcohol," said Dan Lynn, who lobbies for the Illinois chapter of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. "We also think it would be good for consumers to be able to cultivate their own cannabis, as well as to have a cap on the licensing fees for the new businesses that would be created by the legislation." Ammons' proposal, which has not yet been assigned to a committee, includes a civil penalty, not a criminal one, of $200 to $400 for minors who attempt to buy marijuana illegally. Also in the bill is a requirement that at least 51% of the licenses for cultivating facilities and retail cannabis stores be issued in communities disproportionately harmed by the war on drugs, which the bill defines as census tracts in which more than half the population is African American, Native American, Hispanic, or Latino. The bill also would authorize medical researchers to use cannabis in studies, as long as the participants are at least 21 years old. Revenue for the state would be generated by a 10% excise tax on the sale or transfer of marijuana from a cultivating facility to a retail store. Half of that money would be paid into the state's main checking account, while 30% would go to the common school fund. Smaller percentages of the revenue would be distributed to various state retirement systems, the Department of Human Services to fund treatment programs for tobacco, alcohol, and cannabis abuse, and to the Department of State Police for hiring and training drug recognition efforts. There is no official estimate of how much revenue the bill would generate. Lynn said Normal will have a lobbying day at the State House on Wednesday, February 20th, the same day Pritzker is scheduled to give his budget address to the legislature. And with Pritzker's backing of legalization, Lynn said he thinks there is a good chance something will pass this year. "I think there's a strong push to make it happen as quickly as possible so that we can create these jobs and bring in this needed revenue," he said. Still, any effort towards legalization is certain to meet resistance. The Illinois Catholic Conference recently announced its opposition to legalization. Law enforcement groups, including the Chicago Crime Commission and the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police, have also said they will oppose such a measure, as has the Drug Free America Foundation. The legislation bill is House Bill 902. Next, we'll go to the article. Bill aims to regulate homemade guns, blueprints, by Jerry Nowicki at the Capital News, Illinois. Springfield. A bill introduced last week in the Illinois House would add several layers of state regulation to the production and distribution of 3D printed and home assembled guns and parts. Representative Kathleen Willis, Democrat from Addison, filed House Bill 2253, which would penalize as a Class II felony the possession of an unserialized firearm that has been 3D printed or self-assembled, distribution of downloadable firearm printing instructions unless the distributor performs background checks and procedures consistent with a legal gun transaction, and unlawful manufacture of an unserialized firearm. Class II felonies are punishable by 3 to 7 years in prison and up to $25,000 in fines. "I'm not calling for a ban on them. I'm just saying that you need to have the same background checks as you would if you were going to purchase a regular gun at a gun dealer or a gun shop, and that means you will have to have a valid FOID card," Willis said. The bill also requires a FOID card for anyone possessing unfinished frames or receivers, defined in the bill as a frame or lower receiver blank, casting, or machined body that requires further manufacturing or molding to be used as part of a functional firearm. The unfinished receiver provision contains exceptions for an unfinished part within a manufacturing process that includes serialization, where the name of the manufacturer and an individual serial number. Willis said she understands gun assembly is a hobby for some, but she said unregulated, untraceable guns could be a dangerous tool. Todd Vandermeid of the Federal Firearms Licensees of Illinois, a lobbyist on behalf of gun sellers, called the bill an attempt to criminalize the distribution of information, which goes against the Second Amendment and the First. Vandermeid said there are federal regulations in place that the bill duplicates. Willis's bill requires any 3D printed gun to contain enough metal to be caught by a metal detector, a provision Vandermeid said is already on federal books. And now for some news in local sports, we'll head to the article "Vikings Break Out" by Marvin Holman, Danville. After a few slow games, it took a strong crowd and a strong start to get the Danville boys basketball team offense going. The Vikings got off to a 44-20 halftime lead, as they were able to beat Peoria Richwoods 91-60 on Tuesday during the Pack the Place night in Big 12 conference action. Danville coach Ted Haupt said the Knights were just what the doctor ordered for the team's offense. "The basket opened up for us. We had some games where the offense didn't flow so well, and we had to grind out some wins," Haupt said. "So we were looking for a game where everything opened up and scoring more. And this was one of those games. This was the game we were looking for." Sean Haupt led the way for the balanced attack for Danville with 26 points, with 9 in the second quarter, as the Vikings increased a 19-10 first quarter lead. "He was 4 of 5 from the three-point line, so that was good," Ted Haupt said. "He did a really good job, and his teammates did a good job of finding him, because they know when he gets going, they found him, and he was knocking down the shots." The Vikings had 5 players in double figures, with Haupt 26, Tevin Smith 16, and Nathaniel Hoskins 14, and Robert Stroud and Tavon McClyde each had 10. All but one Danville player scored for the team in the win. Tavon McClyde had 10 points for us off the bench after a little slide, and that is a good for us heading down the road, Hop said. "Overall, it was a great team win, and we are all excited. We have a conference win, and there are 2 games left." Hop also praised the team defense, especially in the first half. "We did a great job in the first half, and we were active defensively," Hop said. "If there was anything that was negative, it is that we were a little loose in the second half and gave them some easy buckets in the paint. We were trading baskets back and forth. We had a cushion and wanted to relax, but I felt that we relaxed a little bit more in the second half." The Vikings are 24-3 overall and have 2 games left in the Big 12 and are in a tie with Normal Community at the top. "If we win out in the conference, we have a guaranteed share of the title," Haupt said. "Normal has a loss, and so do we, and we control our end of it for now, and that is how you want to do it. We won a conference game in a big way tonight." Danville will go on the road Friday to face Peoria Manual, and Haupt said it will not be easy. "Peoria Manual has been playing some good basketball as of late, and it is always tough to play at their place, so hopefully this moment we will carry into Friday," Haupt said. "It was a good overall game tonight. Everyone got a chance to play, and we can't wait for Friday." With the little bit of time we have, let's go to the community brief section to see events that are happening in the area. In Danville, church sponsors dance. First Presbyterian Church's youth group will host a Valentine's dance from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday at 100 North Franklin Street. Enter through the northwest doors from the parking lot. Free to the public. Entertainment by Bev Wolf and light refreshments will be served. Book club to meet. Pages to Pictures Book and Movie Club invites participants to read the book, watch the movie, at the Danville Public Library, and then discuss both afterward. This month, participants will discuss Crazy Rich Asians by John M. Chu after watching the 2018 film adaptation. The movie begins at 1 p.m. on Saturday in the first floor meeting room. From Catlin, Auto Club to meet. Members of the Ileana Antique Auto Club will meet at 6 p.m. on Thursday in the Catlin Village Hall for their Valentine's Day meeting. Participants should bring table service and a covered dish or dessert to share. Breakfast planned. The Catlin Masonic Lodge will serve an all-you-can-eat breakfast from 7 to 11 a.m. on Saturday at the Lodge Hall at 107 North Sandusky Street. Free. Donations will also be accepted. From Cayuga, Indiana, meal scheduled. The Women's Auxiliary of Cayuga American Legion will serve a chicken dinner from 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Saturday at the Post. Cost will be $10 for adults and $5 for children 12 and under. That's about all the time we have for today's reading. Once again, this has been Ian with the commercial news, dated Wednesday, February 13th, 2019. Thanks for joining me.